All right, so I'm taping this for the podcast, which we have 250 of the last talks available. So one of the difficulties in putting together a talk on sex is that the bulk of the Buddhist teachings were to monastics, renunciates. And monastics and renunciates take an oath not to have sex. So that clears up that issue pretty fucking quickly. And the Buddha, unlike a lot of spiritual teachers, didn't like to muck about in prescribing certain kinds of sexual behavior in lay practitioners. In fact, he rarely mentioned in the many suttas directed towards lay practitioners, there's not really a great deal of specifics. Most teachers, when they do talk about sex, just simply present the precept against what precept of what is improper sexual misconduct, which is one of the five precepts, and that's pretty much it. Tonight I'm going to try to go a lot deeper to talk about the way the domain of sexuality can be both hopefully pleasant, but also the times that it can be co-opted by craving and unskillful behaviors that will cause us suffering. And a lot of this I'm going to be doing based on my interpretation of the Pali Canon. Now, I've been practicing for 30 years, but I only first started studying the Pali Canon in 1997, which is only 16 years, and there's a fuck of a lot of the Pali Canon. It is massive, and there's a lot of differing interpretations on every subject. So my interpretation is just one interpretation. I'm grounding it on readings and stuff I've been instructed on by various monks that I've been fortunate enough to study with. But still, in the end, I'm owning this as my interpretation, and there are many, many other valid interpretations of what the Buddha taught, especially when we're going into the realm of constructing views that the Buddha didn't specifically articulate. So I'm going to start with the precepts and then work my way out. The precepts are basically summaries of karma. Karma is the very basic teaching that there are causes for both our happiness and our suffering. And those causes are largely found in our own acts, specifically our own intentional acts, our own intentional speech, our own intentional thoughts. We tend to blame our suffering on the world, but actually a lot of the difficulties, miseries we experience in the human realm come from what the Buddha called the second arrows we shoot into ourselves. So all of the precepts fall under the domain of the path to happiness, which is to say that if we're not wanting happiness, true lasting inner peace, to be the goal of our lives, a lot of these precepts won't make sense. The Buddha said all of his teachings flow in one direction, which is towards that which establishes lasting, unconditional, unbinding from suffering and peace. Now, if that's not what you're after, some of these precepts simply won't do. And that's not everybody's after that. When my parents were immigrants, very, very poor, and the one thing they wanted most of all was just to establish some financial security and status in an alien world which was especially inhospitable. And so the idea of establishing lasting inner peace was not very important to them. Likewise, there are people who are also deeply interested or invested in the idea that simply consuming short-term sensual pleasures over and over and over again as fast as possible is what life's all about. Bling culture. The divination and the enshrinement of all that is fleeting but pleasurable in doses. And that's fine too. Consumer culture, whatever, it's great. I'm not judging it. I'm simply saying that if we want to establish a mind that's peaceful and serene, that there are other practices we have to undertake, and those practices are basically encapsulated in these precepts, which are guidelines. They're not sacraments. There's no God overseeing you. Nobody's going to judge you if you fall short. You are the one that's going to experience the mental agitation that results when we undertake a precept and then we don't live up to it. But there's no God sitting on top of some cloud throwing lightning bolts at you or whatever. Basically, the idea is that these are the guidelines for how to navigate towards inner peace. The first few are pretty incontroversial, which are basically you don't kill or harm others, you don't steal. If we want to have a mind that's peaceful, we don't lie. We don't engage in intoxicants which cause, intoxicants that basically cause unawareness or unskillfulness. And finally, we don't engage in harmful sex. And that's summarized in Kamiso Mikara Viramani Sika Padam Samadhyami, which is the Pali for don't fuck up. No, it's a Pali for avoiding sexual misconduct. What is sexual misconduct? It is when people engage in sexual activity when one or both are in a monogamous relationship with somebody else. In other words, there's lying, cheating, evasion. There's no that I can safely report. There's no statement that the Buddha made that if two people are in open relationships, which is very, very popular these days with the kids, with the youth, when I was in college. I was making out with a girl and then I became aware of an additional hand in the mix. And it freaked me the fuck out. So I at that point knew that kind of culture wasn't for me personally, but making no judgments. This is no judgments here. I don't know why I'm doing this with my hand. This is thousands of years of Jewish repression, like, battling everything I'm talking about. But if one or both people are in a relationship with somebody else where they have presented themselves as being monogamous, then that's misconduct. Anything that involves lying, skulking, dissemination. And the reason why this is a precept is obvious, because lying, hiding, compartmentalizing, denying, these are not healthy, happy, serene mind states. They hardwire a form of really unskillful behavior into the mind that makes it very difficult for the mind to develop openness and awareness and honesty. So that's the reason why this is specifically one of the precepts. Now, the Buddha didn't elevate sexual misconduct above any of the other precepts. It's no worse in the precepts than lying or engaging in intoxicants or stealing. It's just one of them. If we fall short, the idea is not to sit around beating up on ourselves, but to see, to experience, without denial or self-justification, what arises as a result. To note what these behaviors create. We can use the times we fall short, if we fall short in this arena, to see, wow, this doesn't feel good. This creates a sense of agitation, a sense of denial, a sense of busyness in the mind, justifying, or a sense of getting away with things, or whatever. If we don't agree with a precept, then we don't have to take it. If you don't agree with this precept, don't take it if you're ever taking the precepts. It's fine to simply recite four and not all five. If you agree with a precept, but you're not sure you can uphold it, try the best you can and see what the results are. Sometimes, for example, when it comes to intoxicants, people really don't believe that the couple of beers or whatever that they engage in after work is leading to intoxication and unskillfulness. And at first, it doesn't. But then over time, they become more and more subtly aware of the lack of mindfulness, the changes in attitude, the unskillful situations that might arise, and they drop it, and that's fine. It can be a gradual process. It's not one at all remotely similar to the sacraments where we're judged and pronounced sinful. None of that is in the practice of the precepts. The precepts simply say that's to show us where what kind of behaviors is going to cause us suffering and agitation. So, when it comes to marriage, contraception, homosexuality, which are my next batch, there is no sacrament of marriage in Theravadan or Pali culture. There's nothing immoral about people who aren't married having sex. So don't get married. No, you can get married. Especially in Theravadan countries, monks will show up at weddings of people they know, and they might even add a blessing, but that has no spiritual role whatsoever. And if somebody gets divorced, that has no spiritual significance whatsoever. Divorce, marriage, doesn't have anything to do in the Buddhist teachings with the behaviors that will lead us towards lasting peace. In terms of contraception, there is no prohibition against it. If you're planning not to have babies, I urge you to use it. You heard it here.
Can you plug in the...
Thanks, Liam. So, in terms of the Buddhist teachings on homosexuality, there is practically nothing in the original text that can be found that he talked about to lay practitioners. In the Vinaya, the teachings and the rule books to monks, there's nothing that prohibits gay practitioners from joining the order of the monks and the nuns. There was, in fact, a couple of cases in the Vinaya of a man who became a woman, and that's the word choices they used, that was ordained with the nuns, and a woman who became a man who ordained with the monks. However, there was, bizarrely, a prohibition against what's known as pandakas, eunuchs, from ordaining. And there's a lot of assumptions that at the time, apparently, eunuchs were associated with prostitution. And apparently, whoever added that in didn't want the Sangha to be associated with people who were sex workers. There's been attempts to make that term mean more than it did. There's no indication, though, that it meant anything other than eunuchs. Now, there's been many commentaries added on after the Pali Canon where somewhat conservative and repressive voices have attempted to twist and add more homophobic language than was originally present. It's one of those odd situations where in the original text there really wasn't that much, but over time people have tried to add it. But if you stick closely with the teachings in the Pali Canon, there's very little for us, even in our from our perceptions 2,500 years later, to get upset with. Now, sex is often, when I've heard it being discussed by lay teachers, such as myself, they often put it in this very genteel language, like, when it's done out of love and an expression of the closeness that two people feel for each other, can be a wonderful addition to any couple, blah, 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 blah. You know, bullshit, it's fun. It feels fucking good. Be fucking honest. It feels fucking good. So how do we determine when grinding it out crosses... I love that meme. In the gay community, Grindr is like the... I love that name. Grindr is like the hookup app. Much like Craigslist, OkCupid, Match, you get it. But Grindr, I just love. So anyway, so grinding it out. as opposed to squeezing one out, which is masturbation. So, how to know you're at Dharma Punks, right? Okay. So, sexuality is, though, a domain where craving can very, and addiction can very easily creep in, and basically co-opt these very natural urges. And so the trick becomes, as practitioners, to know when a very natural desire has been turned into something that's no longer bringing us a sense of pleasure, a sense of joy, a sense of relief, or whatever, but is actually doing us some disservice, which in turn is creating more suffering, more stress, lowering our self-esteem, isolating us from others, and so on. There's a number of different ways to tell. The first is, of course, when we bring craving to sexuality, it's when we expect it to do something that it cannot do. By which I mean, we all experience loneliness, confusion, a lack of purpose, great senses of alienation from the world, a feeling of confusion as to what our role in life is supposed to be, what we're supposed to be doing. And there can be a very great temptation when these very complex, difficult to experience states arise, that rather than addressing them, investigating them, seeing what needs to be unpacked, instead, when we face these experiences, we tend to run towards that which gives us really quick short-term pleasure. When people feel grief, rejection, dismay, confusion, abandonment, loss, lack of connection, they might drink or they might hide in narratives on the television or get lost in other consumables. We might shop, or of course we might seek the brief connection that happens through sex. And sex, while it can bring pleasure and a sense of closeness, it cannot address these deeper human experiences. If we're using sex as a way to distract ourselves from a greater sense of rejection, isolation, or feelings of lack of worthiness, we're going to find these experiences only worsening. For example, if we've believed that we can address our sense of low self-esteem and a lack of worthiness by simply being attractive and getting someone to have sex with us, that relief is going to be profoundly short-term. And the dismay and discouragement and all the rest will come flooding back. And not only will it be back unaddressed, but will have added addiction into the mix. And how much fun is that, really? So whether it's food or shopping or consumer culture or whatever it is, sex as well, if we avoid looking into the dark feelings that arise and are invariably in life, we can do ourselves great injustice, and we can put off seeking real solutions. The neurotransmitters that arise during sex are a wonderful heady brew. You got, in the beginning, before you get the big payoff. That's right. Before the big payoff, you get dopamine and adrenaline and acetylcholine, and boy, are you awake and alive and in the mix. You're in the saddle. You're on the go. You're in the game. You're on the run. You're not doing any of those things they just said. You're just having a lot of fun. And then when you get the release, then we get all the flooding of serotonin and oxytocin, the closeness drug, and then we get the great, like, relaxing and easing in the body, the feeling of the muscles which were tense then become released, and that feels really great. And these feelings can feel like, wow, this is the point of it all. And people can even get caught up in, I'm a really sexual being, because that's when I truly express myself. That's nice, but all you're experiencing is you're just loving the nice mix and flow of neurotransmitters and stuff. You're on drugs. And it's easy to feel we're on top of our game when we're on these, like, drugs in the brain that are there to reward us for keeping the species going, even though that's probably not what you're doing. The human brain thinks it's a survival for the species and for our self-organ. It thinks, oh yeah, I'm hammering away. This is great stuff. And it can make all the problems and difficulties of life blur away and get lost. And you know what? Nothing's being addressed. Nothing's being looked at. We still have the bills to pay. We still have the alienating jobs. We still have the lack of repaired connections with loved ones. We still have the feelings of there's something amiss. Now, another indication of where things can go dreadfully wrong is in this age of fast, impersonal hookups. There's a tendency also for people to engage in sex without intimacy. And sex without intimacy, in and of itself, is not necessarily, unavoidably, unskillful, that is leading towards emotional or mental stress, discomfort. But it is really rife with the possibility of becoming unskillful. By which I mean people who become attracted to sex without intimacy, studies show, are very often people who in childhood didn't establish or weren't allowed to establish secure connections with their caretakers. And thus, they find any form of intimacy disruptive in sexuality. They're basically in sex without intimacy, reenacting the feelings of disconnection, the feelings of suppression, the feelings of performing to get attention. It's reenacting these very early infant behaviors where the infant doesn't feel in and of itself it's worthy of the caretaker's attention, so it performs to get love from the mother or father. And people who experience that in infancy very often go on to be people who seek sex without the complication of true, deep, open connection, real communication, spontaneous emotions, expression of deep feelings. They simply want to have a sort of shut down, dissociative sex. And this can be really, really problematical. And so rather than prescribing it, I'd simply say, if this is something that any of us is attracted to, we should investigate it. Because very often it can be a symptom of stuff that really needs to be addressed. Because it's not worth playing around with. Finally, sex and Dharma punks. Dharma, this space is, and every space where we get together as a spiritual community and meditate, is a safe space, which means I really discourage using this room as a place to flirt or to try to hook up with somebody. I've actually married quite a few people who have actually met at Dharma Punk, so I've done. I'm not saying that, you know, what goes on outside of that doorway, I'm in no way trying to legislate. But while we're here together, if we view this as a place to meet and hook up, then we're going to fall into the tendency of objectifying each other, of gravitating towards people we find attractive and avoiding people we don't find attractive. We're going to miss the point of a spiritual place, which is to open our hearts to everyone without an agenda. So I ask that, and thankfully we've been overall really, really good at that. But it's worth mentioning in this talk. Obviously, if you see somebody outside of Dharma Punks and you think that they're the top banana. Just every word, my vocabulary just disappeared and was like. So that was totally phallocentric. Let's come up with. The cat's meow. You think they're the cat's meow?
Some cat's meows are really annoying.
Yeah. Okay. So some they're not. They're the cat's meow that's not annoying. And you try to envision how you would want somebody that you really really love to be approached, and be really really open to any suggestion that if they're not into it, that's fine. Try to basically treat people with the utmost respect that you've met here, so that this can always be a safe space, both inside and outside. Because we want people to come here and feel this is a refuge from a world where people are not only abusive, but also there's just so much in our culture, undertones of rape, and misogyny and violence and all that. Just to have a space where we can reduce that is so valuable. It's not worth risking it for a date unless you're absolutely fucking certain and you're doing it in your in a way that's extremely, extremely mindful. Last of all, there should teachers with practitioners, no go. None of you, thankfully, are rushing to my door. And that's good. That shows you got healthy boundaries. Because virtually every single branch of every single spiritual community, from Buddhism to Hinduism, to has been just absolutely polluted when teachers allow themselves to wind up in any kind of sexual activity with students. In my book, that's never acceptable. Once you walk through that doorway, you are safe from me. Except the shit that comes out of my mouth. That you're totally vulnerable to. So that's it. That's an overview of sex. Some different things now for us to think about. I'm going to turn off the tape, and I lastly hope it was as good for you as it was for me.